Concession number 33503, Reel 2.
And us poor sods were sent into the desert to hold them up. At least that was the theory. Anyway, this captain, I didn't even know his name. He came round talking to us and explained the position. He said that we've got to become fighting men now. That was a laugh. There was nothing there. No protection whatsoever. We were just a load of blokes and a few vehicles dumped in the desert. And we're supposed to take on the German army. Well, the order of the day was dig trenches, so we dug trenches. Just like the 1914 war, at least what I hear of it. And we got down there with our 303 rifles. That was a laugh, 303 rifles. And the old padre came round. Keep going, men. God is with you. Keep going. And we did. Kept looking, waiting, wondering what was going to happen. And we just had to sleep by the trenches where we were. When it got dark that night, firing started. Obviously the Germans were getting nearer. And we could see the tracer bullets through the air. So things got a bit sticky, and the following morning we was being attacked. We could see dust in the distance, and obviously created by tanks. We were all told to start firing with our 303 rifles, and that's what we did. We were just firing at the dust. Slowly, the dust got a bit bigger. I mean, in the desert you could see vast distances. And this dust turned out to be tanks, German tanks. And they got nearer. And we still get firing. We don't know what we were firing at. We were firing with our 303 rifles, probably hitting about 100 yards in front of the plain desert. Anyway, the captain in charge of the powers that be probably decided it was very little good us fighting on, because there was no doubt about it. Within a couple of hours we'd have just been mown into the sand. He sent for one of the light tanks and stuck a pole up with a white flag on it, white sheet. And off drove the tank with one of the officers towards the dust specks. So we assumed that we had backed it in. Anyway, there's a couple of blokes there getting ready. We were walking around this place. It's a bit of activity. Blokes were getting ready to be handcuffed, or whatever we thought was going to happen to us. Perhaps even shot. And there was a couple of blokes in this 15 underweight truck. And I wandered over. The bloke was looking at the engine. I said, "What are you trying to do?" He said, "I'm going to make a dive for it." I said, "Where to?" He said, "Well, to Brook, where else?" There was the driver. There was another bloke. Don't know his name. And there was another fella called, I know his name because his name was Williams. And there was me. So I said, "Right, I'm with you." We started up the truck, 15 underweight truck it was, like a builder's truck, no body on it, just a flat bit at the back. It was loaded up with petrol. And everybody was running around, nobody noticed us. And the bloke said, the driver, obviously been driving around, he said, "It's quite easy." He said, "The route to the book is marked out by petrol tanks. You only got to get on the main road." He said, "And there's no Germans there. We can get straight through." This was the plan. And off we went. We saw the tanks moving on the Fort McKinley, and we got a couple of miles away, and we stopped and looked back. We realised they'd been taken prisoner. But we kept on, we started to keep on. But of course we didn't know at the time that we'd been shadowed by a couple of German tanks. And we drove on. And then this remarkable thing happened. By this time we could see the speck of dust of the tank, and it was moving closer on our offside. And there's the last four blokes in the truck, driving like mad across the desert. The tank got nearer. These light tanks, they did phenomenal speed, 70, 80 miles an hour, some of them, even faster than the truck we was in. Anyway, we went on, and apparently the tank got us in its sights. And it fired. And we could hear the shots coming over. One or two of them were armless. Just went armless over the top. We could hear them whizzing by. And then this, as I said, remarkable thing happened. We were all crouching down in the truck. The driver was at his wheel. This bloke, I never knew his name, was sitting next to him. Crouched with his hands on his legs. And Williams and me were in the back. One of these two-pounders came and hit us. Well, it hit us. Best way to describe it. It hit this man crouching beside the driver. It went clean through his legs and his arms, straight into the driver. The driver was killed instantly. The truck spun round, hit a sand dune. The other man was screaming his head off. And we looked at him, and we nearly died with fright. Half his legs and half his arms had gone. The shell had gone right between them. Williams and I both jumped up, got down, and the tanks were moving in. There was two of them. Within a couple of minutes, they caught up. The tank opened up, and there was a German officer with a Tommy gun. He could speak a bit of English, but not much. We gathered what he knew as well as we knew, that we were prisoners of war. He held his gun towards us. And then Williams, who was a bit of a funny bloke anyway, decided to make a run for it. I don't know what he was running, he must have just lost his nut, he just must have went berserk like that. He just started to run. And they shot him. They left him where he stood, where he fell. So, there was the driver dead, the other bloke screaming his head off, Williams dead, and me alive, but a prisoner of war. The Germans put me on the tank, one of their tanks, and drove us back to Fort McKinley. By this time, all the Western men surrendered. And I was put in amongst the other 3,000 men. Prisoner of war. Number 2585471. The other man, with the terrible injuries, was taken by the other tank and apparently taken to the nearest town. I think it was Derna, a place called Derna, under German occupation. And that's the last we saw him. At least, I thought so. Funny enough, I met up with him about 18 months later, when I was in Sulmona. He'd spent the 18 months in hospital, this chap, apparently. And he was being repatriated, and he came through our camp at Sulmona. He was in a bit of a state, he couldn't walk. But we saw each other, we recognised each other and put our arms around each other, you know, we were sort of blood brothers like, saw the end together. But there was this poor fellow, he had half his legs away, scooped away by a shell, the size of a 2-pound shell, and half his arms. But the Archives certainly looked after him. He'd been in hospital at Naples for 18 months. And they sewn him and patched him up, did this and that. But he couldn't use his hands, all the tendons had been cut right through. But the doctors there assured him that when he got back to England, with the wonders of modern medicine, they could do something for him, you know, give him hands that work, and probably even stretch him up so that his legs would walk too, with crutches. He was cheerful enough. He got to live with it by now. He lived somewhere up in the Midlands, Huddersfield or somewhere like that, like Kellett. We didn't spend long together, because he was just passing through Solmona Camp on the way. There was about five seriously injured prisoners being repatriated. They were being exchanged for Italians in the same circumstance. There's one thing about the Italians, at least they were a bit more like Christians, more Christians than the Germans were. The Germans would never repatriate anybody, not in my knowledge anyway. But the Italians did from time to time. And that's the end of that story. Getting back to McKeeley, you remember the tank dumped me off and I was just a prisoner. I mixed in with the other 3,000 men. And it was Good Friday. And we more or less had to wait there until they took us to Derna, this town, coastal town, about 40 miles away, across the desert. Apparently the Archives, who took charge of us from then on, only allocated one truck for this job, and you can imagine 3,000 men take a long time, taking 40 miles there, 40 miles back. Anyway, as far as I remember, we were there for about 5 days, at least I was. Days and nights, the days were very hot, and our water ration was something like a pint a day, and it was terrible. Our tongues were hanging out, parched. To make matters worse, there was a well nearby that apparently our blokes, when they retreated, poured petrol down the well to stop the Archives using it. Consequently, any water that came to us came via this well, and it tasted terrible. Petrol. And as I found out later on, it didn't do much for our health either. The Archives were coming amongst us, offering pints, 2 pints, half a gallon, depending on what they could get for it. Gold watches were going to the Archives. Watches worth a lot of money, you know, men, their last possessions. Anything for a drink. And the Archives were raking it in. Money, watches, rings, and the chaps were giving it all just for a drop of water. Contaminated water at that. But at least it seemed to quench our thirst a bit. And we slept there, we've all huddled together, surrounded by machine guns. We couldn't move very far, we slept there, we did everything there. Talk about sanitary conditions. They just didn't exist. One or two of us had overcoats to keep us warm at night, but we just huddled together. But slowly they got the numbers down. They were taking them every hour or so to Derna. I eventually got on the truck. About 60 to the truck. We were packed like cattle. Just pushed in the truck, rammed right in. Eventually arrived at this place called Derna. And they put us into a kind of a courtyard surrounded by huts. Just beds in the huts, and we just pushed in there, and that was it. That was our home until they could take us from there along the coastal road to Tripoli and then across the Med into Italy. But of course, the time we got to Tripoli was about 5 or 6 weeks, and we did have a very nice time, at least I didn't. The water in, there was a courtyard, as I said before, and there was a well in the courtyard. And it was a very old-fashioned idea of the bucket dropping down and just filled itself out of water, and you just wound it up in a bucket and drank it. We could look down the well and see these little termites swimming about in the well. I don't know if they were fish, they didn't look like fish, they looked like little insects and things like that. One or two of the blokes refused to drink it, and the Itai's attitude was, if you didn't want it, don't drink it. You'll get nothing else. Eventually that was it, that was our water, and we drank it. The other rations were very, very scarce. We didn't get much. We got bowls of soup mainly, a few potatoes and things like that. And about a couple of days later, we all stopped, or at least several of us, started to go down with dysentery, and I was one of them. And we was confined to our beds. Well, I've never heard of dysentery much. You don't hear much of it in England. It's just a world, because I don't wish that on anybody. It's a terrible thing, terrible disease. You feel like somebody's sticking knives in your stomach, wrenching your stomach. You die 24 hours a day. It's terrible. In fact, one or two folks did pass on. They were very bad, and no medical supplies. There was just a corporal from the ambulance corps there, captured with the rest of us. He did what he could. The Itai's had no medical supplies. He just walked around wiping our mess up, and that's how we lived. Most of the fit chaps took their turn of getting on the lorry and going towards Tripoli. Apparently there was another camp at Tripoli, and from there we were going on to Italy. But the sick ones, of course, held back. We just couldn't move. They couldn't move us, and the corporal said that we couldn't be moved, and that was it. We just stay in our bed. We just push food down our throats every now and again, and that's it. We were in a terrible state. Eventually we came to a point where the Itai said they've got to go. Load them into the lorries, that's it. Well, I amongst the other fellows, there's about 12 of us left in, with this dysentery. We thought, this is the end, we're never going to survive, and the lorry with the roads were not made up, you know, they were pretty bad, the road, that coast road was all boulders and everything. And the great big three and five ton trucks they were putting you in, hard as nails. And they just piled us in these trucks. They had to lift us in. And we started a journey of about 300 or 400 miles. We stopped at night. The guards got out. Took the turn on guard. We weren't going to do it. We weren't going anywhere. And during the day, they stopped now and again for us to get down by the roadside. And one or two people used to come out from the villages and look at us. And spit. And that's how it was for about 3 or 4 days, I remember. It was a case of either kill or cure, I think. I know when I first started out, I didn't think I'd last half an hour. But the jogging and the bashing of the lorry and the shouting and the hollering, you were just laying in a crumple, you just wanted to die. But somehow, you just didn't. And I know by the time we reached Tripoli, about 4 or 5 days later, I was a lot better than when I started. I could almost stand up. I was very weak. I weighed about 7 stone. Long beard, like all of us. Very dirty, stunk to high heaven. And I remember Tripoli very well. Very nice town, the look of it. But it wasn't very nice for us. They drove us around the town to let the natives see what the Itai's had captured. We looked a sorry sight. And I remember at one or two places they stopped, and the civilians, who were mostly Italians, picked up pieces of brick and threw them at us. Just to show the displeasure. Because the Itai's had a bad time in North Africa, and they were trying to get their own back on us. But we couldn't care much. One or two of us got hit by bricks, and faces were cut. That was the least of our troubles. Our trouble was keeping alive then. They took us through the town of Tripoli, to the outskirts, into another prisoner of war camp. It was on the edge of the desert. And we were there. We stayed there for about 3 weeks. Eventually, marched down to the docks. Put on cargo boats, we were put in the hold. And we had a trip across the Med. It was a very uncomfortable trip, actually. We could hear the guns and shouting. Obviously, our chaps were trying to sink them. Well, they sank one or two ships in the convoy. We heard that one or two ships, even with men on board, had gone down. Prisoners of war had been torpedoed. Anyway, we was going to get home. We was going to get there, and we did. We finally arrived at Naples. And that was the start of 2 years being a prisoner of war in Italy. Actually, the next 2 years weren't too bad. They were pretty easy going, the ITIs. They didn't make us work. They got machine happy from time to time. And one or two instances where blokes were shot for answering back and things like that. But by and large, they weren't too bad. And as I say, I finally arrived at Sulmona. And a chief worry was boredom. Until, of course, we went to Germany. But at least for the time being, for 18 months or so, 2 years, we had more of a peaceful time. We didn't know what was going on at home. We got letters very occasionally. And we could write out. Don't know how many got home, one or two got home, I know. We got Red Cross parcels sent out. We got those fairly regularly. They were full of food, tinned food, one parcel of each man, except in certain times when they got short and it was pushing the war effort. The lorries didn't get through to Switzerland, that's where they came from. And eventually there was a hold-up. Then we had to rely on Italian provisions, which weren't very much. But anyway, we got through. And as I said, by and large, it wasn't a bad time.
When I walked through the gates of Stella 8B for the first time, I felt shattered. Talk about rock bottom. Here was I with bits of paper, addresses, etc., to visit people in England, to tell them their husbands, boyfriends were safe in Italy. I even had one in Birmingham. I remember I had visions of taking an excursion for the day. Talk about love. I never took that excursion. Anyway, here I was at the gates of Stalagate B, ready to start my second session of being a prisoner of war. Of course, I didn't know at that time that I had 2.5 years to serve. And I think that if I had known what I was in for the next 2.5 years, I think probably I would have climbed the nearest tree and died dead off first. But I didn't, and there I was. And there I am. Everything turned out all right, as it happens. But life from now on was going to be a complete change from what I experienced in Italy. First of all, there were the German guards. Now, I can only speak from experience. I know that some of our chaps who were captured early on in the war, those at Dunkirk, there were thousands taken at Dunkirk, and the German war machine had hardly got going, and they weren't ready for big prisoners of war, you know, big numbers of prisoners of war. So some of the chaps that captured on earlier were sent to small farms, little villages, perhaps 2 men on a farm, and they almost came part of the family. And after speaking to one or two fellas later on, you know, they had quite a good time. But speaking from my own personal experience, my opinion of the Germans, or the German guards, well, they were nothing else but evil bees. You know what B stands for. A slight step out of line, and down come the rifle butt across your back, or even your head sometimes. It was nothing unusual to see a man with his side of his ear cut open. And they had several little tricks they liked to play. For instance, when we were at working camp later on, the rally was about 5:30 in the morning. For the rally, they just put the lights on. The Germans controlled the lights. There were no switches in the huts. The lights went out at 9:30, and at 5:30 they came on, and you knew you had to get up. Time you had a scrub round, a wash, and a cup of coffee or something like that, you were ready for work at 6:30. It was just about 5 minutes before reporting outside for work. They used to blow a whistle, and then 5 minutes later they came in to clear out the people that hung behind, you know, with the rifle butts. If you were in your room after about 5 minutes after the whistle went, you were soon got outside. But now and again, when they were in a frivolous mood, the guards, about 10 or 12 of them, would get inside the huts, then blow the whistle and immediately open the doors and come in with the rifle butts swinging, just for a laugh. Being a prisoner of war, we soon realised that if we wanted to survive, we had to step very, very warily. Some men were shot for the silliest reasons, and if a guard shot a prisoner, nothing happened to him. In fact, in most cases, he was sent home with 3 or 4 days' leave and came back on another working party. In all fairness, I think it ought to say that most of the guards were men, quite a few of them young men, who had been on the Russian front. They used to do a spell of several months on the Russian front, and there they were taking a bit of a hammering. Apart from the weather, the Russians were steadily advancing. And after a few months, we understand, they were sent home for a short spell at home, you know, working as prisoner of war guards, just to get them back in on form again, ready to send them back to the front. And you can imagine that they weren't too well disposed to people like us. The German civilians we didn't meet very often. Occasionally we had contact with them in offices and something like that, places of work, you know. And almost without exception, they treated us prisoners with complete contempt, even spat. Funnily enough, it was the young girls that used to spit at us. Most of the civilians were made up of older men, too old for the front, a few older women, and mostly young girls. Of course, all the young men were at the front fighting. And I suppose the young girls had fathers and boyfriends out in the front taking a hammer in, and they used to have it out on us. During my 2.5 years in Germany, except for the first 3 weeks, two or three weeks in Lambsdorff, I spent practically the whole of the time in working camps. I suppose I went to probably about 6 or 8 working camps during the time, and they varied in size. Some of them only had 20, 30 men in them, you know, went out to small jobs in factories, nearby factories and things like that. Other camps had 200 or 300 people in them. The Germans had records of our trades and professions, I suppose. These were supplied by the Red Cross. I suppose we intended to help us as much as them. Anyway, I was down as an electrician, and most of the jobs I was sent on was to do with electrical work. The first camp I went to was Auschwitz, celebrated Auschwitz, where the Jewish camp was. I think I spent a few months there, as far as I can remember. I know it was all I can really remember, that it was bitterly cold. It was in the height of the winter, and the snow and the ice were on the ground thick as we walked to work every morning, 6:30. And we had to march to work. There was quite a few of us in the camp, and we worked at a huge factory being built, factory combine of several buildings, like a small town being built nearby. And at the same time, the Jews came out to work. They were called the Judens. That's the German name for Jew. We called them pajama boys because they had just a fairly thin striped suit on so they could be seen easy when they were running away or trying to escape. Striped, kind of a striped, just like a pyjama set. And we were pretty down at the time, but these people were in a terrible state. They were given very little food, and you could see men and women all together, all their hair shaven off completely. You couldn't tell the men from the women hardly. And most of them were just scarecrows. And as I say, they were made to work. I mean, the work they did was nothing, I suppose.